2194-CR, State v. Delgado. Representing the defendant, Mr. Delgado, is Attorney Joseph E. Schubert. Mr. Schubert, we're ready for you to proceed.
May it please the court, counsel, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Joseph E. Schubert, and I'm representing the defendant, appellant, petitioner in this case, Carlos R. Delgado. Mr. Delgado, at present, is serving a 120-year sentence in the Wisconsin state prison systems as imposed upon him way back in 1993. At present, he's incarcerated in the state of Tennessee. I think of Mr. Delgado serving 120 years, and I think of the various constitutional rights which were meant to protect him. And right off the bat, I'm struck by various things that the state does in its brief. It makes certain factual distinctions which I submit do not affect the principles that I want this court to follow, that Mr. Delgado wants this court to follow in deciding this case. For example, with regard to the case of U.S. Ex Rel DeVita v. McCorkle at 248 Fed Second 1, the state states that, well, that was a death penalty case. And the issue there was whether the defendant would serve life imprisonment or whether there'd be a death penalty, and the state says, well, therefore we shouldn't apply the case. Making factual distinctions such as that does not eliminate the principles that the court should follow. Remember, in that case, the court presumed bias on the part of a juror that gave inaccurate information during voir dire. And I asked the court to use that case as a foundation for finding in this case that bias with regard to Juror Callahan should be presumed or inferred. Remember in McCorkle, a juror did not say that he was a victim of an armed robbery that occurred just a matter of months before the armed robbery trial that he was sitting on. The factual distinctions that the state makes with regard to McCorkle don't make the principles inapplicable to the case at bar. Mr. Delgado is serving 120 years. That's significant. He was constitutionally entitled to a fair trial and a fair and impartial jury. That's his constitutional right, whether he's facing a disorderly conduct charge, whether he's facing a charge that carries 120 years in prison, and in this case, he received the maximum possible penalty, or whether he's facing the death penalty charge. He was denied his right to a trial, his constitutional right to a trial before a fair and impartial jury. And the court should find that it should presume bias on the part of Juror Callahan and find that the second prong of Weiss has been satisfied. In this case, under the record that we have, we know clearly that during voir dire, Juror Callahan was asked whether she had been the victim of a sexual assault. She was also asked whether she had been the victim of crime. Even though that we learned in the post-conviction hearing that these questions made her think about her previous victimization, she withheld that information during voir dire. In the post-conviction hearing, she had two explanations, really. She said that she didn't feel she had to speak during voir dire because the sexual assault wasn't reported. But yet she also testified that she didn't answer affirmatively because she felt that the other jurors that were answering affirmatively were having to prove before everybody that they had these things happen, either to a loved one or to themselves. We have inconsistent reports of why this wasn't reported. The second report that she gave seems to indicate that she didn't want to go through the trouble of having to mention anything and in effect have to prove that she was indeed a victim of sexual assault during voir dire, so she kept her mouth shut. Does an explanation like that indicate to us that she's more likely to believe a victim and not a defendant in a case such as this? I believe that it does.
Mr. Schubert, let me, if I might, interrupt for a couple minutes and ask you why you feel that we should have a presumption of bias. In other words, why we should presume that the second prong of the Weiss test is met here.
The McCorkle Court tells us that. McCorkle Court, and Weiss does too, State v. Weiss, the Wisconsin case, it tells us that one wouldn't expect a juror who had given incorrect information during voir dire to come forth in post-conviction matters or in any time and admit bias. That, you know, common sense tells us that after a situation like that, a juror would not come forth and say, I sinned, I was wrong, I withheld information. In fact, I am biased. The McCorkle Court cited Justice Marshall and said, a person may declare that he feels no prejudice in the case, and yet the law cautiously incapacitates him from serving on the jury because it suspects prejudice and because, in general, persons in a similar situation would feel prejudice.
Well, in this particular situation, as I understand it, we've got a juror who says, I didn't answer the question about sexual assault because it wasn't a crime. And the first question that was asked in terms of whether or not anyone had been a victim of a crime. Then she answers in regard to other questions that were more specific and clearly that she should have given an answer to. She answers that she was concerned because she was embarrassed. She didn't want to sit there and explain in front of a crowded courtroom and other jurors what her situation was, what had occurred to her when she was 6 or 7 years of age. How do those answers and that explanation show bias? Why should we jump from there to a presumption of bias?
We have three answers, really, as to why she gave inaccurate information. The answer that you just gave, Your Honor, was the answer that was submitted via offer of proof from Juror Rouche. Juror Rouche wasn't allowed to testify, if you remember, but we did indicate to the court what she would say. That was done in the first hearing before Judge D'Amato, and it was also done before Judge Kremers. And Juror Rouche said, no, she didn't say that she didn't do it because it wasn't reported. She didn't say that she didn't do it because she thought she'd have to prove a sexual assault. But she told us that, or me, that she didn't do it because she was embarrassed and ashamed. So we have three different versions of why, under the circumstances, credibility, her, you know, we have an issue with regard to credibility. This lady, we have nothing more from Judge Kremers than a leading question, if you will. You weren't biased, were you? No. You know, a lady who gives three answers, one of which is incredible, certainly because it wasn't reported, because three other jurors talked about cases where sexual assaults occurred and it wasn't reported. So for her to say that it wasn't reported is incredible and unbelievable. And it makes Judge Kremer's finding incredible and you know, makes it that it should be overturned.
You're not asking, and as I understand your answer, you're not asking for a presumption of bias every time the first prong of Weiss is satisfied. You're asking for it in this particular case, and you're basing it on a question of credibility in terms of her explanations. Is that correct?
Yes, and also the facts of this particular case. We're dealing with a sexual assault case. And, you know, the again, I feel that the state makes an insignificant factual distinction because the state says Well, in the armed robbery case in McCorkle, which you want the court to use to support your position, that armed robbery occurred just a short time before the trial. And this occurred 40 years ago. So, you know, there's a big difference. You shouldn't use it. But it's significant enough that the juror brings it up during deliberations, after not telling about it during the voir dire. And certainly, it was on her mind. She brought it up in a setting where they had a dissenting juror. And in order to sway this dissenting juror, the juror Callahan says, you know, you won't reason with us. You know, we're at wit's end. You don't know how it feels to be the victim of a sexual assault. I do. Now, indications such as that surely show bias. Not only gives us a basis for presuming bias, it outright shows it, because this lady used something in her life that she didn't tell about during voir dire to sway a dissenting juror. How can the court's factual finding that this woman wasn't biased? It can't. That's, you know, you know, and also I'd point out that, you know, armed robbery, sexual assault, differences between the cases. And I would say that the Weiss case in Wisconsin does parallel the McCorkle case. I just used McCorkle because it's a fact situation that is more clear on point, where the court did presume bias, did find bias.
But in Weiss, we concluded there was no bias. How do you distinguish that?
But it gave us the proper law to use. It did say that it is proper and the court should presume bias in various cases, or should infer bias, because we wouldn't expect someone to admit to it at a post-conviction proceeding. And the Weiss gave us the analysis. You know, the court said you could presume bias if we have a material disclosure by a juror resulting from a purposely incorrect answer, a deliberate concealment, or other mendacious conduct.
What page do you find that?
I believe it's on page 731.
But in Weiss, the juror was asked a direct question, withheld information. Isn't that right? Or didn't completely answer it. In this case, was the juror asked?
Oh, yes. The entire panel was definitely asked. Have any of you ever been...
So you're under Weiss.
Oh, yes. And we have evidence of a material disclosure, or of a material non-disclosure that was purposeful.
Did she hear the other jurors discuss their response to the question? Or was that all done in chambers, or was some of it in chambers and some of it in court?
It was all done in court.
Okay, all in all, even though the judge made an offer that you could, if you were embarrassed or didn't want to talk in front of everybody, you could come into closed chambers.
I'm pretty sure of that. I'm not positive. I wouldn't swear to it. But if I remember, Your Honor, it was discussed in open court. The questions were put, and various jurors talked about sexual assaults that weren't reported and their experiences with that. That is at page 730, 731 of the Weiss case.
730?
Right, 730 and 731,
okay.
Where it talks about when you have a material non-disclosure that was purposely incorrect. And I feel we have that here. The juror in post-conviction proceedings even admitted that she thought about the previous sexual assault. It was in her mind, you know, so there was a spark brought out there. And I think the evidence shows that it was a purposeful non-disclosure.
Counsel, wasn't there some testimony or some disclosures made in chambers, too?
Some were, I believe. But I believe many were...
Know what that was about? Those things in chambers?
In the original trial?
Yes.
Well, what? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I, as I understand, in it, that the talk about sexual assaults that were recorded and not reported came about in open court, or you know, there was discussion of that would alert Jura Callahan as to what she should, you know, what was the purpose of the voir dire questions. And I point out, this was, you know, not only were you the victim of crime, but were you the victim of sexual assault, various people talked about it. You know, there was a lot involved in the question that should have alerted, and I believe did alert Jura Callahan, that she should have affirmatively responded. The Weiss case gives us an analysis of the factors that we should use, and these were pretty much ignored by both the trial court and the Court of Appeals. You know, did the question, the voir dire, talking about voir dire questions, but it says, in determining presumptions of bias, it should consider the prospective jurors' answers in voir dire, and the court should consider the following. Did the question ask sufficiently inquire into the subject matter to be disclosed? Were the responses of the other jurors to the same question sufficient to put a reasonable person on notice that an answer was required? And finally, did the juror become aware of the false and misleading answer during the trial and fail to notify the court? She became aware of it. It became an issue in deliberations, and it wasn't brought to the attention of the court. All of the factors of Weiss under that analysis are met in this case, and therefore allows us to infer or presume that there was bias. There's evidence that absent any inference or presumption to support a bias finding.
And what is that?
The fact that during deliberations, she actually brings this up for the first time. She interjects it. She, you know, in order to sway a dissenting juror. And what does that have to do with the facts of the case? You don't know how it feels to be the victim. I do. That goes to the heart of the matter. That is an indication of bias.
Well, is that competent evidence under 906.062?
Under Masselt, it is. Masselt says that 906.062 does not apply when you're doing the Weiss analysis. Now, again, the state makes an insignificant factual distinction, saying, you know, this was a different sort of fact case, and right off the bat, I remember what facts were in that case. But
question wasn't asked, or he didn't say in response to a question. There was 10-year-old gossip, and I think that there was no question about what. Well, they knew things outside, so there wasn't a response, which is the first issue under Weiss. I think that was right.
And in Masselt, the court actually asserts that principle, which the state says all ignore, that under 906.062, you should be able to go into what's said during the deliberations, because where else are you going to get evidence of bias? That, you know, we're not going into the sacrosanct deliberations of the jury for a meaningless reason. We have a reason here. This is it. You know, Masselt says we're going to allow that journey into jury deliberations only for an analysis of whether incorrect information was given and whether there was bias. And I would also cite the court to Tobias v. Smith, because Tobias v. Smith also holds that the federal counterpart of 906.062 doesn't apply when we are asking bias and asking whether that incorrect answer was given. So the court should apply to bias in Masselt and allow what was said during jury deliberations to be a part of the evidence to show bias. The state, I believe, didn't address the Tobias ruling or make any factual distinctions in that regard, because that case is right on point as to whether 906.062 should apply.
In subsection 2, it does create an exception, of course, for extraneous information.
Right.
Are you depending upon that exception, that this is extraneous information?
I think it plays a role. I think we can.
Well, why would this be extraneous? Does it have anything? Does it have something to do? And I read some reference of this information to the fact that this is it's extraneous information. Somebody makes this up because the information that they were discussing had nothing to do with the defendant. It was not as if somebody was saying, hey, this defendant's been convicted 6 times in the past. I know it because I read it in the newspaper last week. This extraneous information was with respect to the jury.
I feel it interjects her prejudice wrongfully into the jury deliberations. And I would submit that's not the biggest point because I'm not really proceeding under that section of the statute. We feel that deliberations should be allowed to be taken into account based on myself and Tobias. But, you know, I think extraneous information under this does play a role and should play a role in the court's decision making. I have but 5 minutes. The important thing I want to address, if the court does not find that the second prong of Weiss has been met, bias, be it actual presumed, you know, we should overturn the trial court on that issue. What the trial court did was severely hogtie Mr. Delgado and severely hogtie me in the ability to prove bias. Tobias, all the other cases that I cite say that the defendant should be given an opportunity to have a full hearing to discuss whether this juror was biased. That wasn't given here. I couldn't ask questions of Callahan. I submit that an attorney's cross-examination is different than having a judge ask leading questions and doesn't go toward the truth.
Counsel, for my own purposes, I can't speak for the other court, but I thought that in those four errors that you alleged having to do with respect to the hearing, your possible strongest point was that some of the questions, particularly those questions relating to how this impacted on the juror, is maybe your strongest argument. I'd like you to address that.
Judge, what's more important than being able to ask the question, what happened to you? What effect did it have on you? You know, where is your head at now? You know, to determine whether bias is there. You know, that was devastating for the court, you know, treating the juror with kid gloves to say, you know, I know it's hard on you and all this, but, you know, so therefore we're not going to ask you the specifics. You know, I needed to know what occurred.
What would that have done for you? What would that have given the judge if she had been allowed to answer those questions?
Remember, I couldn't even talk to the juror.
Right,
you know,
what if the judge had asked those questions on your behalf?
Well, we're speculating as to what she would say. But we know for a fact that it goes right to the heart of whether she was biased. What effect did this have on you? What happened? Was it a similar case to this? Were you devastated by it? I imagine so. She's talking about it during jury deliberations. You know, it goes to the very heart of the considerations the court should have in determining bias. I think that is our strongest point, too. But all in all, the defense was hogtied. You know, not only not being asked, not being able to ask questions, we couldn't follow up after the judge asked the questions. You know, I submitted more on the record. The Court of Appeals called these questions de minimis. You know, they go to the very heart of the matter. The trial court and it abused its discretion, gave no reasons for what it did, other than trying to save the juror embarrassment or whatever. I don't know. Is my time up?
You have a few moments. Your time will be up at the red light, but you need not use all your time, and you will have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Okay, even if it goes to stop? But you know, this is the first chance I've gotten to talk. Seriously, because in the trial court I couldn't do anything. And that, you know,
a little frustrating, counsel.
Judge.
Let me tell you.
But you know, and the judge placed the convenience of the juror above the constitutional rights of Mr. Delgado. And there was no reason for it.
end on a high note, counsel. So Lunston, Assistant Attorney General Paul Lunston.
Chief Justice, members of the court.
We haven't seen you for a while, Mr. Lunston. He argued the prior case, which is...
I'm getting a little rusty.
How can you keep them separate?
We're having a hard time.
Well, I don't know how you keep 6 or 7 or 8 cases separate when you have them over time. You know, forgive me if I don't feel sorry for defense counsel here. He is not truthful when he says he couldn't talk to Juror Callahan. He could have interviewed Juror Callahan. There was only a brief, there was only a time frame after the post-conviction motion was brought and issues were discussed. There was only a short time frame under which the judge issued an order preventing him from talking to Juror Callahan. Before that, he was completely free to talk to Juror Callahan. I don't know if he tried. There's no record that he ever tried.
Counsel, don't we have a series of cases that express concern by this court about counsel going to jurors after the gate has been shut and intimidating or discouraging them? We've expressed real concern about that, haven't we?
Well, there's so many things to talk about, and that's an interesting topic. You know, I don't believe you've ever really said anything. I mean, in the federal system, they have a procedure where you need to request a judge's permission to question jurors. We don't have that. We rely very heavily on the rule 90606, which limits the incentives. There aren't very many reasons why you would want to go question jurors, and that's pretty much how we protect jurors from harassment and protect the process. But there isn't anything to prevent defense attorneys from questioning every juror in every case after a verdict comes in.
I believe the advice usually given to jurors are, you don't have to talk to anybody.
That's true. I don't know if there's any reason to think that Juror Callahan wouldn't have submitted to an interview. She might have called the district attorney, asked, what should I do? The district attorney might have said, you can talk to him, you cannot talk to him. If you want to have one of us present, we'll be present with you when you talk to him. I mean, I think that avenue was available to the defense attorney. Maybe more important is what Justice Babich was talking about in terms of
whether this is extraneous information.
Well, that's, again, I am having a little trouble keeping these cases straight.
Have you figured your train of thought? If so, go ahead.
Well, I do want to address the extraneous information issue. Juror Callahan brought up this issue in the jury room in just the right way. We expect jurors to draw on their experiences. If you've been drinking and driving, and it's a drunk driving trial, you don't get excluded. And when it comes time to deliberate, and you're assessing the credibility of the defendant's story, you can draw on your own experiences of having a drinking and driving.
Isn't the problem that because of the information that she withheld for whatever reason, it is obviously sensitive to her, but it had a profound impact, and there would be little doubt, maybe some, that having indicated that she had suffered that experience, that she would not even be on the jury. She would have been excused from the jury initially. So that's a concern.
It's a good issue, but I don't agree at all that she would have been excluded. And it's a distinguishing issue from McCorkle. He's talked a lot about McCorkle. I think I'll come back to that because he's...
But tell me why you don't think that she would have been excluded.
If she had said, I was assaulted when I was 6, and she answered the question honestly, we would have proceeded under a fair and sort of analysis.
Yes.
She would have been asked questions about, you know, roughly speaking, what happened. We don't usually put jurors through a detailed questioning about what happened. But we would have found out what we did find out, that 40 years ago she was assaulted, that it wasn't like this situation, it wasn't a parent, it wasn't her father assaulting her, it was a non-relative. And in effect, she was asked in this case, you know, what effect did it have on you? Because she was asked in the very context of this, you know, did it affect how you were going to view this case? And she very clearly says it had no, you know, it did not affect how I was going to view this case. She said there was nothing about that prior abuse. Her view of it or her recollection of it that made her feel she could not be fair and impartial. And she said there's, you know, more broadly, she said there was nothing in her background that would make her vote guilty if the state didn't prove its case beyond reasonable doubt. That's exactly the kind of inquiry that would have been made under Farron. Just because she was a sexual assault victim does not mean that we would have presumed bias. We have a lot of case law to that effect. You know, earlier on, he's dropped a lot of his arguments. I'm not sure how many of them he's dropped. But one thing that he argued early on, the defendant that is, was that we should assume that all victims of sexual assault, you know, that kind of crime, are biased. And there's just no support for that in the case law. We don't assume that crime victims, even of the very same crime.
But we do start to raise our eyebrows when a juror either answers inaccurately or incompletely. And we raise our eyebrows even further when we look at these three factors outlined with Weiss, or Weiss, however you pronounce it.
Elmer Curley Weiss.
Curley, that's crazy. When, in fact, all of this stuff was going on around that juror to alert the juror as to what was going on. And that's very troubling to me. At least my eyebrows get raised by that.
Sure. Well, there's two things I want to address. And one is, you know, whether she lied or not. And the other is the inhibition on the questioning that was asked, directed at that. I agree that the vast majority of jurors who heard the questions in this case would have assumed that they were being asked if they had been assaulted, regardless whether there had been a criminal prosecution. So that's agreed. Everybody agrees to that. The question is whether or not this particular juror had that in mind when she was answering the questions. We've had two trial court judges question her eye to eye, listen to her explanation, and assess her credibility. And as, you know, as unusual as it sounds, she persuasively told both of those judges that she had got off kilter, and thought that it had a particular legal meaning in this context. I'm not saying that that was reasonable of her to do it, but it's not something that could not happen. It's not something that's incredible as a matter of law. So it was a tough judgment call for the judge to make. He had to do, you know, exactly what you're not in a position to do. He had to sit face to face with that juror and assess her credibility. Is she lying to me or is she not?
You've got more to answer, but I want to just interject this because it sounds to me like I'm not with the right test. I thought Wise test isn't whether or not she lied, but whether or not her response was correct. And I thought that even the state was suggesting it wasn't correct. So yeah. Why are you talking about lying? But don't forget your train of thought.
No. I mean, the reason we're talking about whether or not she lied or not is because if she intentionally lied.
Is that the test for Wise? I don't think so, is it? I might be wrong, but I thought it was juror didn't, whether or not she answered correctly or completely.
The test for Weiss is, as you say, whether or not it's a correct or incomplete answer. But Weiss also talks about that it's important, or it can be important in a particular case, whether that incorrect answer was intentional or non-intentional. So that if you give an intentionally incorrect answer, that should raise in your mind some suspicion that there is might have been a bad motive for lying to the judge, knowingly lying to the judge. Whereas if you innocently give an incorrect answer, then you don't have that sort of problem. You don't have a suspicion that the juror was trying to hide something from the judge so that she or he could get on the jury and cause problems.
So the trial court thought that when she responded to the court that she interpreted it to mean crime, it wasn't a crime because there was no report, there was no conviction. And that she would be embarrassed to talk about it, that she was honest and truthful, even though she was mistaken, and that the question called for her to give another answer.
Yes.
And that's what the trial judge found.
But one of the questions made no reference to crime. It just says, have you been a victim of the sexual abuse?
Yes, and I suspect even the trial judge came into the hearing thinking, probably going to find that she was a liar. I mean, you read this record, and you would come into it thinking, boy, this question was pretty clear. How could you have been mistaken?
Go to the second part, though. I mean, the first part is as an objective matter.
Right,
it doesn't matter what she thought. I mean, you ask somebody a question. I ask you, are you on Superior on Thursday, October 8th at 11:50? And you say no. I mean, we all know you're here. You're not responsive, but you thought that it's not October 8th, or you didn't hear it as Superior. You heard it as Ashland, or whatever you thought. You responded perfectly honestly, but looking at it, you gave an incorrect or incomplete response. So that's the first test, which is objective. But it seems to me, therefore, that whether she was intentionally lying or whether this was just an innocent mistake would go to the second test as to whether or not it's more probable than not that there's bias.
Exactly.
Is that your point?
It's exactly my point. I concede the first prong, and I say, but the Weiss case says that whether or not she was intentionally deceitful is important with respect to the second prong. And on that score, I mean, I want to develop the facts a little bit more. Even the offer of proof with regard to Juror Rusch, the other juror, supports her assertion. Even Juror Rusch says in the offer of proof about what she would have testified, that in the jury room, Juror Callahan, the one we're talking about, indicated that it hadn't been a crime, that there was no prosecution. I mean, it isn't something that she thought of after the fact when she was contacted after trial. In the offer of proof from the defense, we have evidence that that's what she was in fact thinking at the time of the trial. And the trial judge, I think, reasonably said that her comment about being embarrassed is as she said. She would have been embarrassed to talk about it, but in her view, she didn't need to talk about it. The other jurors talked about it, but in her view, they weren't required to talk about it.
Mr. Lundstrom, I accept what the trial judges said, because they had the opportunity to observe her, that she was, in fact, credible. And so I don't take the credibility. When I look at the second prong, I'm not saying to myself, well, she intentionally lied, because I've got the trial court saying she didn't intentionally lie. But I almost view it the next, as that flows on, even more serious, because if she didn't intentionally lie, she really must be a very troubled person to have said that she wasn't, to have sat silent when she was asked if she was a victim of a crime, to have sat silent when she was asked whether she'd been a victim of child abuse or sexual abuse, to have sat silent when she heard five other of her fellow jurors talk about their own experiences, three of whom had not reported it to the police, when she sat silent when the judge invited any of them to come into chambers, and three of them accepted that invitation if they were too embarrassed. That, to me, at least, it's sort of like the dog not barking in the night. You know, there's something very wrong here.
Well, I'm unclear as to
she didn't respond could show a very deep-seated bias, more deep-seated than possibly intentionally lying might show.
Well, if you're accepting the trial judge's finding that she didn't think she was required to admit or to tell everyone in court that she had been previously sexually assaulted or anyone else, then I'm not sure why the rest of that flows.
I'm very sympathetic to this juror. I mean, she underwent, presumably, a very horrible experience, but by not responding at any of these times, this litany that I just gave you, it may very well show a very deep-seated psychological hurt that couldn't help but affect her.
Exactly.
Well, that's possible. I mean, that is. I don't believe that that's the view. That's a factual finding. What you're talking about is assuming a fact, assuming that this juror had a deep psychological problem that prevented her from at least raising the possibility with the judge that maybe she should answer the question. That's a factual finding, and it runs contrary to to what the trial court found when he found that she was credible. It's that view of the facts doesn't support the trial court's finding that she was credible and honest. There's nothing. And his ultimate finding that he rejected the motion. I mean, if you follow the proper appellate procedure,
Where the judge considered that potential.
And when judges don't specifically address a factual issue, the proper appellate procedure for this court is to assume facts that support the trial judge's decision, because you don't have the ability to find facts. You don't have the ability to go back and question Juror Callahan about what she was thinking or whether she had a psychological problem or to relitigate that issue. So just as good jurisprudence, you should assume facts that support the trial judge's decision. Once you go down that road of kind of what if, what might be the case, you know, every conviction's in trouble.
Mr. Lundstrom, as I understand it, five other people testified to some experience that they knew about, either personal or family member or something. Did any of those people become part of the actual jury?
I don't recall.
The record show there were three that got on the jury that were on the panel, but two were struck by the defense, one by the state.
I'm not sure about the answer. I know that there
could have been the other.
The ones that were keeping straight.
Be careful. I don't remember.
I didn't have either one of these cases in the Court of Appeals.
No.
I had this case a long time ago, and somebody else had it, and now I've got it again. To answer your question, I don't know the answer, and I don't think it matters. They're not challenging the propriety of any of those other jurors, so I don't think it matters.
But if, in fact, people were struck, doesn't it go to the question of whether if this juror had answered truthfully, she probably would have been struck?
Well, you could look at the record and you might be able to get a better handle on whether this trial judge would have struck the juror. So to that extent, you know, I guess you might gain some insight. But when you do if she had answered honestly, and if this was a Farron case where we're reviewing whether or not a request to strike for cause was properly or improperly denied, then your appellate standard of review would be whether or not she gave a sincere assurance that she would put that prior experience behind her and whether she could. And we know from Justice Wilcox is shaking his head, and when I talk about Farron, I have to pay attention to that.
Go ahead.
I'm the one that's shaking their head when you talk about Farron.
But we know from Farron that this would have been an okay case, because she provides a very clear retroactive assurance that it wouldn't have affected her. I mean, this is kind of a stilted look at things, but we're trying to do a retroactive sort of Farron approach to things. Farron itself doesn't apply quite tidily, but if this were a Farron case, what I'm saying to you is her post-conviction hearing answers indicate she would have passed muster under Farron, no question, because she provides what the judge found to be a very sincere assurance she could put it aside, and it is something that our case law demonstrates unequivocally jurors can put aside.
Now, I think the problem, and I don't look at this as a Farron problem, I think this, as a former defense counsel a long time ago, it would seem to me that in this kind of case, that if a juror had this background, that it's just absolutely crucial that I would have the opportunity to use at least one of my strikes on that person. That's where it would bother me more than a Farron consideration where we're talking about the cause. So that was part of my first question to you, is that by her non-disclosure. So anyway,
I'd just like, if we can, to get back to quote the law to be applied. Once we can read the record, and I don't want to start you from the facts, but I want to know what the legal standards are to be applied. Now, we heard, and I'm going to go, will you hear counsel for the last case at 9? Okay, well, there was a discussion of Poe, which is referred to in the song. That's the competent evidence, went to the jury, reasonable possibility. Okay. This and what was the facts in Coa? I mean, was it extraneous information before trial?
Driving homicide case, and the jurors had heard that he had prior convictions.
When did they hear it?
During the course of the trial.
Okay, so that's during the course of the trial, extraneous information about the defendant. In Weiss, a juror incorrectly responded to a question, had information before trial, right? And the test is more probable than not with Weiss. Is that right?
Yes.
But Weiss, the questions there were whether he lived in Dane County, whether this juror lived in Dane County, which was inaccurate, and there was a second question, but that had nothing to do with the defendant or with the fact that he came.
Right, so that the second prong in Weiss wasn't very difficult.
Yes, that we threw it out on the second prong.
Yes.
Right, so okay, unbiased, right, but an incorrect response.
I want this cleared up,
and that's why I'm careful, because I may be mistaken as to what test I'm on. Now, is the Weiss test any different than the Poe test? Because then my next question is Nassault. That's the third case. And then I'm going to ask you, is that any different? So is the Weiss test any different than Poe? Are these the same tests stated slightly differently?
They're different tests because...
Okay, why?
With the difference is that in extraneous information cases, you...
No misstatement to the...
In the pure extraneous information case where there is no lying, you then view it in terms of a hypothetical average juror. How would this affect your normal reasonable juror?
Right.
In Weiss, you dictated the analysis is that we're going to do a retroactive bias determination on this individual juror, whether this particular person, not a hypothetical person, but whether this particular person was biased.
And it's triggered only by an incomplete or incorrect answer.
Yeah. Yes. So...
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't mean...
You're right on target,
yeah,
so I'd like
it
again.
Isn't the test... what am I looking for? The standard of review different? It's triggered by an incorrect or incomplete answer, then we look at it to see if it's more probable than not. Whereas if it's an extraneous information, we look at whether there's manifest bias.
Reasonable possibility it affected the outcome.
Manifest bias is a different test than harmless error.
Okay.
So
it's a harmless error test in Poe.
In Poe, it's a harmless error test.
But not the was the burden on the state?
In Poe, yeah, I think the defendant has the burden of going forward initially to show extraneous information.
Okay.
But the ultimate burden goes back to the state.
Okay, so Weiss misresponse, and more probable than not that there's actual bias by this juror, and if that becomes what, a matter of law or fact by the trial judge?
It's a mixed question. To the extent that the trial judge makes credibility determinations and along that line, then those are factual findings.
But the totality of it, we look in terms of the legal standard.
Yes.
Okay. Assault. This was 10 years previously, there was gossip, right? That this juror, pretrial information, gossip about this defendant in the assault, right?
Yes.
Now, is it a Poe or a Weiss case? That is, was the juror asked a question that they should have responded? I knew this information. I think there was the information was a possible prior rape, but he had never been convicted and maybe not even charged. Now, in that case, the reason I ask you that is because I want to know whether it gets into Weiss or Poe, or it's a third category. And when I reread it, it seemed to me that there was a kind of dispute as to whether or not, if you look at page 270, and I'm on 185, we're second, if you have it. Miss Elt. Oh, I'm sorry, 270. and there they looked at Weiss for purposefully giving an incorrect response. I'm sort of going back to your first part. So what kind of case is Nassault?
I think Nassault has both issues. There were multiple jurors, and part of the case deals with extraneous information, and part of it deals with the Weiss type analysis.
Same juror? Or
no.
At least one juror had extraneous information and didn't respond?
Well, there's a complicated fact situation.
I know. I have trouble with it when I reread it, and I'm trying to fit it in. So what do you think Nassault holds?
Well, I think that Nassault follows.
And I'm sorry, would you stand in front of the microphone so we can be taping you?
I'm sorry.
No problem. It's
consistent with all of the other case law. I mean, it's consistent with Weiss in that circumstance, it follows the Weiss analysis when it's faced with an incorrect response by jurors, and it does a straightforward Weiss analysis. But I believe elsewhere, dealing with other jurors, it engages in a Poe-type analysis with extraneous information.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it says it's unwilling to imply bias in the self from the fact situation. Okay. So I read in the self to say that the test there is clear and convincing evidence that the juror made or heard extraneous statements about the defendant, and that you apply the prejudice test, which sounds like Poe.
Yes. The best I can answer is that my recollection is that there were multiple jurors, and that as to some they applied Poe in the extraneous information analysis.
And just my final question, which of these tests, Poe, Weiss, or Nassault, which you say is a combination of the other two, is to be applied here? Just very
Weiss.
Weiss.
Or Weiss.
Because it's jury here is an incorrect response, so it fits right into Weiss. We don't... Okay.
Yes.
Yes.
Very straightforward in that respect.
You would agree that if we find that there was bias, there's a new test.
I would agree. And going back to the earlier argument, if you have a biased juror, then one biased juror is enough. We don't want any biased jurors. But the question is, do you even approach it from that direction? And your jurisprudence says that in a Weiss situation, you do. You look to see whether this is a biased juror. So we're talking about whether Juror Callahan was biased or not. And this morning, earlier, we weren't talking about whether Juror McCann was in fact biased. That came up in a different context.
Mr. Lundstrom, let me ask you, while you've still got a little bit of time left, about the hearing that the Court of Appeals ordered in regard to bias. What's your response to Mr. Schubert's points that two key questions were not asked? Basically, what happened to you and what effect did it have on you? Now, the Court of Appeals said that was error. Do you agree with that?
I think it was error. Just the way the Court of Appeals phrases it, it was error, but those were not critical questions. Because Carlos Delgado assaulted his daughters multiple times over a long period of time, a lot of different ways. Chances are that some of those instances were going to parallel the assault suffered one time by Mrs. Callahan 40 years ago. If there were, let's assume for argument that there were some factual similarities with one of the assaults inflicted on Carlos Delgado's daughters. I think we can all assume that that's true. There's probably going to be some factual similarity. But we know it's not a father. It's not an ongoing assault. And we have this juror talking about how she feels about it. The important issue is how does she feel about it? And she does talk about that. And she says, and I don't want to repeat myself, but she provides a very direct assurance that nothing about that assault would affect her ability to be an impartial juror in this case. She is providing her assurance. And that is the key question, because only she really knows whether she can put it aside or not. And a judge has to rely on jurors. He has to look them in the eye and make that determination about whether they're being truthful or not. The alternative approach is just to presume bias and just say, we can't have any crime victims be jurors anymore because we don't know if we can trust you or not.
So that's a crux of the difference between the two of you, that one to argue that, listen, a person who has had this experience, he makes this outburst, perhaps that's an exaggeration, at deliberations, is per se prejudice.
The way she talked about it in deliberations was
just...
I'm sorry, okay. I didn't mean to cut you off.
But your position is, look, the judge found that she was being truthful when she said she could set it aside. And so is it this difference of per se versus case by case that's an essence here or not? Am I missing that?
Well, what we know about deliberations is that she was saying, I understand why a child in this situation would delay in reporting or didn't report on time with these children. That's exactly the way she should have used her prior experience. That's exactly the way jurors are supposed to use their common prior experience in the affairs of life. So what she said in that jury room was exactly the way we would expect her to use her prior experience. It's not a biased way to use it. It's a way she has some insight into how that victim might have felt based on her prior legitimate experience. That does not make her biased against Carlos Delgado.
Justice Babbage has a question for you.
Just a follow-up, Mr. Lundstrom, to where I was 15 minutes ago with respect to assuming that she was telling the truth and the judge is correct. Given the face of all of this fact, given, you know, all of this that was going on around her during the voir dire, I'm not talking about during the deliberations, but during the voir dire, what is the other explanation for her not coming forward?
I think the straightforward one, that she had some, you know, that she got off on a tangent. For some reason, she got it into her head that she didn't have to answer this question, and because she didn't feel she had to answer the question, she wasn't going to offer it.
But I find that very difficult to accept, given the fact that other people were questioned right in her presence about, you know, being victims, and some of them hadn't reported, and she was given the opportunity to not be embarrassed by going into chambers. And that's the only... I'm looking for alternatives.
And so I suspect if you had been the trial judge, maybe that feeling of yours might have led you to a different conclusion, and you might have listened to her, saw her be very sincere, and reached a different conclusion than the trial judge did. But that's not... respectfully, that's not your role here. Your role here is to say whether a reasonable trial judge could have decided that she was truthful, that she was confused, but honestly confused.
My role is to search for alternatives, since I assume she's not lying.
Yes.
My role is to search for other alternatives. And the only alternative you have given me is that she was... I guess, confused.
I don't mean to be glib at all or disrespectful in any way, but she, the view that the trial judge took of this evidence, of this woman, two trial judges, Judge D'Amato and Judge Kremers, was that although she told a story that was, you know, didn't seem very likely, that when they looked her in the eye, listened to her story, they decided, well, this is the unusual case. This is the person who got off on a tangent, but is a very sincere person, wanted to do a good job, provided me a believable assertion that she was in the right frame of mind when she was chosen as the juror in this case. And so to do anything, if you accept the judge's finding, then I think what flows from it is his argument falls apart. She wasn't lying, and there's no reason to suspect that she was a biased juror. The alternative is to, I think, the only alternative is to find that the trial judge was clearly erroneous, that he missed the boat, and overturn him because his factual finding was clearly erroneous.
Thank you, Mr. Lundstrom. Mr. Schubert?
The trial court's finding with regard to bias was indeed clearly erroneous. This court can overturn based on that fact. There was an abuse of discretion in the finding with regard to whether this juror was biased. Justice Babbage is correct. There was something with regard to this juror that was wrong, that was that is indicative of bias.
Well, how about she was embarrassed? That's what she testified to, and that's what she told the jurors in the deliberation room. I'm not sure embarrassment is wrong, is it?
No, but the fact is she gave three different explanations.
Okay, well, let's take the embarrassment as one of the viable ones, as opposed to crime. It wasn't a reported crime.
Well, does embarrassment excuse what she did? You know, when a juror is sworn to tell the truth and asked to give information that's very important to the people in the case.
Does embarrassment necessarily translate into bias? I guess
it's evident.
It's the question. Does it make it because she didn't vote? Let's say hypothetically she didn't because she was embarrassed. Does that translate into then a per se finding that anyone who previously has been sexually assaulted and doesn't acknowledge it cannot be an impartial juror, even though they testified that in post-conviction that would not affect her and that she could be a partial impartial juror?
First of all, we don't urge the court to come up with a law that says it's per se or a juror is per se biased when sitting on a jury where the issue is the same type of crime that they've been a victim.
What makes her biased in this case? That she didn't answer the question? Is that what makes her biased in this case?
I think there are many points. You know, the fact that the fact that she first of all gave incorrect information is something that the court may consider in determining whether she was biased. Second of all, she brought it up during deliberations to sway a dissenting juror. You know, you don't know how it feels. I do. So I'm basing this on my feeling as the victim of a sexual assault rather than the facts.